So are we ready?
Good morning, how are you?
Good morning, we are convening today's meeting of the Joint Tax Credits Committee. Welcome, everyone. When we last saw you, we were in the middle of a couple of committee hearings on RETC, so I'm going to open them back up. I'm going to open public hearing on House Bill 2522A and Senate Bill 688A. As you recall, these were discussions around RETC, and there were a number of folks who didn't get a chance to testify as we ran out of time. So I'm going to try and call you up if you're here. Some folks I'm not seeing. To give you a chance, Patrick Story, yeah? And let's see, Tom O'Connor, did you? Yes. And I'm not paying attention to for or against here, so I'm, let's see, Patrick Story, Tom O'Connor, John Chandler, you're back there. Why don't you come up and we'll fill. They're both open gentlemen, so. Please proceed, and we appreciate your indulgence in coming back. Sorry we didn't get to you last time.
I should start?
Yes.
I'm Patrick Story, and I volunteer with Tax Fairness Oregon, and thank you for this opportunity. First, we support the elimination of tax credits for home furnaces and home appliances. We heard Senator Dingfelter testify to this last time, but we're a little confused about furnaces. In 688, a section says furnaces that have efficiency ratings of 94% or less are not eligible, and we think that maybe this means that furnaces with 95% and above are still eligible, and we think that that's not the case and hope that you will clarify that. About appliances, I think as we also heard Senator Dingfelter on that, most appliances sold today are actually energy efficient. The marketplace has evolved hugely just in the last 2 years, and it's moved past any need for subsidies. When in February, in the coldest week of the winter, I had the pleasure of replacing our gas furnace at home, the installer did not say a word about any kind of tax refund. And later, when I thought about it and asked him, he said, we don't mention that because we think we might get it wrong, because I had already heard there was something out there. To their credit, after I called the office a couple of times, they sent me the form to fill out, but it was just something they didn't feel any need to bring up at all. I did get the 95% efficiency just because it's obvious that it'll pay for itself after a certain number of years, but the rebate had nothing to do with it. Moving on quickly to other recommendations, we have heard testimony that the sealing of heating ducts can result in a 25% energy reduction. The general public, I think, is not up on this, and we're hoping that you could take the lead by requiring the inspection and sealing of ducts prior to installation of subsidized solar panels, solar thermal, or wind, and that would be the same for furnaces if furnaces are still involved. This would be a way to affect energy use, we think, hugely, if you would foreground it and bring it to the attention of the public. Moving on, we think there should be an overall limit to biofuel subsidies to $200 per vehicle.
Wait a minute. Is this
the bill's bill?
Did they agree with that?
Okay.
Keep going.
Biofuels have already been heavily subsidized through Betsy as well as through RETC. And they, which currently provide a tax rebate of up to $200 per vehicle per year. And that's apparently, from what we can tell, no matter what percentage biofuels contribute to the fuel mixture. And this rebate is being carried out at a time when a new tax on electric vehicles is being sought. More disturbingly, one company Sequential has so far received $5.8 million in Betsy's and $8.8 million in five state energy loan program loans. We think that's enough. Moving on to seek economies of scale for solar panels, just briefly, subsidies are offered for both homes and businesses, but businesses offer much more economy of scale, and we're hoping that you will foreground those and promote those ahead of the much smaller jobs done on private homes. It would be a way to bring cost control to that program. And finally, we hope you will establish caps for solar subsidies. It's clear that these are growing rapidly. We heard about that last time. And it needs to be capped. And we have a proposal, and that is that if you establish a pre-certification program for solar and wind proposals, similar to that for Betsy, that would provide a solution. And the small cost to operate such a program would far outweigh the risk that we're facing of otherwise experiencing an explosion of cost for this program. And applications for pre-certification could include a fee to cover costs, as with Betsy. That would allow the capping of funding for solar subsidies. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I'll invite questions of Mr. Story before I get to the other two, since his is a different check mark on my box here. Nothing? Yes.
Thank you. Do you have your suggestions in writing?
I do, and I plan to submit them
Thank you.
In writing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Story. Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. Here, liking 2522 better than 688, but specifically would to discuss the residential energy tax credit in a kind of a more general sense, since I would imagine that these particular vehicles may or may not be the ones that actually go forward in the current form. Just to give you a bit of background, you already know how bad the construction industry has been hit by this, and the reason the new construction lobbyist is here in front of you is because we also represent the majority of the remodelers in the state of Oregon as well, and particularly during this economic downturn, basically what I've got left in my industry, since new construction is at a almost a standstill, is remodeling, or deck building, or fence painting, or whatever it is you have that we can do for you. We'd be happy to talk about that after the hearing. This is an industry that's been hit very hard, and I'd like to submit to you that the bills in front of you are not just energy bills, but also jobs bills, in a sense, because they do create work in the marketplace that might not otherwise get done. And in that regard, I'd encourage you to look at, particularly with regard to appliances and furnaces, that there's an energy component and a jobs component. There's also a new construction or major remodeling component, as well as a replacement component. And what I mean is, if you're building a new house right now, and please do see me afterwards, or doing a huge remodel, you're very likely, if you're replacing your furnace, you are going to go buy a high energy efficiency furnace, because that's what the market has mostly available. Part of the reason, rationale behind the RETC credit in the first place, though, wasn't simply to incent that, although that's important, and getting the market to transform into those high energy efficiency furnaces is very critical. It's to give an incentive for somebody sitting there in an old house with an old furnace, the incentive to do something about that in advance of the big remodel, in advance of a tear down and rebuild. That's the market that I think the RETC, as much as anything else, was really aimed at, was trying to get people to act in advance of an existing need to convert out or to do to furnaces to replace infrastructure within their home that might make it more energy efficient. We believe that this has been a remarkably effective program for both jobs and energy savings. And we would encourage you, as you're going forward, we understand how tight the budget is. We understand the pressure that all creditors of all sorts are going to be under. And it would, I'm not going to sit here in front of you and say that this ought to be inviolate, because I understand that wouldn't do me any good. And plus, it needs to be made workable, efficient, no pun intended. Having said that, I would encourage you not to simply discard it because of the pressure from other parts of the state budget, but to recognize there is a component here of cause and effect. You are creating an incentive for people to replace, to improve, to gain energy efficiency, which has all sorts of social benefits, but at the same time create work. And, Madam Chair, members, I'd like to share, in getting ready for this committee hearing and the substantive committee, I sent an email to my membership and asked them, do you use the RETC credit? What is your experience with it? What have you seen? I just have a few excerpts from their emails I'd like to share with you. I deleted company names because they did not authorize me to convey that, but I can certainly find out if you'd like to know which companies these are, and I'll make this available in writing to you or in email to you later. This is the first email I received back, or one of them. 100% of our customers qualify for at least one of the items the tax credit can be applied toward. Often it is three or more items. Our customers are more knowledgeable today than they used to be. They are looking for these credits when they come to see us. These credits help promote energy efficiency, employ more workers in the home building process, help reduce the carbon footprint, and add to the bottom line. I believe it will help our economy to continue the use of the RETC. Another company responded, in using these credits both for building our homes to the Energy Star Silver level, which is what they're building all their homes to, and for solar, in a time when it's important for a builder to differentiate their homes from foreclosures and real estate owned that are on the market, being able to provide affordable energy-saving features is very important. These credits are especially important now when buyers would like these type of features but are still on the learning curve and either can't or don't want to pay full price for them. Another one wrote in that for remodeling, I think the RETC has been very effective. Homeowners pick out and sometimes pay for their appliances directly. The RETC is used as a sales tool by the appliance dealer and by the remodeler, and most consumers buy more efficient appliances because of the RETC. And finally, one of the largest remodeling companies in the state responded, right now, our Clean Energy Works Oregon work through our home performance division is the only growth engine or hiring engine that our company has going. We've moved people over to this division, and they retain jobs, and right now we are working to fill six positions in that division while the rest of the company is coasting along at a just-getting-by level. We get more traction. Certainly, it also gives more credibility to these products when the state gives them a thumbs up through a tax credit. It's got to be worth it. We believe these have been effective in moving markets. We believe they've been effective in changing consumer behavior and consumer purchasing choices, and we hope and ask you to continue them. Be more than happy to work with you in making them as fine-tuned and refined as possible. Be glad to take questions.
Thank you, John. I think I'll go ahead and let Tom finish, and then we'll invite questions from both of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Tom O'Connor with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. I am here to express our support for continuation of the Residential Energy Tax Credit Program. In our heart of hearts, I guess we would like to see some continuation of the appliance efficiency credit. So the House bill looks a little better to us than that. I'll come back to that in a second. Our primary interest, I think, here is I'd like to support some of the testimony you heard before from some of the folks with the duct ceiling programs. And for us also, it's the ductless heat pumps. The energy efficiency side of the RETC, we feel, is a really important component to helping our communities deal with their energy efficiency needs, reducing their energy bills. We do have duct ceiling programs at our utilities. We have them for both site-built houses and mobile homes. We have ductless heat pump programs that are particularly useful in moving people. We have a lot of electric heat in our existing housing, old baseboard style electric heat often. New housing is mostly going gas, but a lot of old housing that has baseboard heat. The option to go to a ductless heat pump, which is much more energy efficient, is an important one for customers, and I think combining the tax credit and the incentives that we have enable a lot of, particularly our lower income customers, to make that transition. So those two are really important. Just a quick word on appliances. I fully recognize that we're in a terrible budget situation. If that has to drop off, so be it. But I guess I would ask you to just at least consider looking at giving the Department of Energy some flexibility to offer appliance credits not just for, quote, energy efficiency appliances, but for appliances that are above code, above some standard level. I mean, the idea behind that credit, at least as I always understood it, was, yes, it was to move the market, and as those appliances became more efficient, my understanding always was that the credit would drop off for those, even if they became, even if they were so-called Energy Star, because Energy Star is a wide range of different kinds of efficiencies. But if the department had some flexibility to set, to keep setting the bar higher and higher, that we could, that would be helpful. That's just a suggestion, and again, we recognize that times are tight, and but it might be something to look at. So, but overall, we certainly support continuation of the residential energy tax credit.
Thank you. Questions for these gentlemen?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just a question for Mr. Chandler. For how does this credit work for the home builders and remodelers? Does the home builder get the credit, or does the person who buys the home have to apply for the credit?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, the credit goes to the individual doing the purchase, the remodel, typically. And what happens in a production construction context, the credits usually aren't a factor, frankly. But in a custom home context or a remodeling context, they are. Because in a production context, you're buying a house in a subdivision, and whatever is in the house, theoretically, the builder could give you the invoice for the furnace, the appliance, what have you, and you could take that through. But in my research getting ready for this, by and large, it was more the remodeling and the custom, which right now, frankly, is basically what our industry is doing. So it is the consumer in those cases is more directly involved in the purchase of the appliances, picking the upgrades, picking the selecting this refrigerator over that one, this furnace over that one, not just buying the stock market or the stock plan that's on the shelf.
A follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes. Please.
So if you have, for example, if you have a subdivision of and where you're marketing energy efficiency and so on, and trying to get one of those ratings, platinum or gold or whatever they have, and you get the appliances, the top of the line appliances in, and yet these are maybe, let's say they're spec houses. Who would get the credit then?
Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, as I understand the process, you could, as a consumer, as a purchaser, get the paperwork from the builder showing this appliance was selected and this is a cost, and then at that point, it's the same thing as you buying it. You've bought it as part of the bigger house. As long as I understand it, as long as you can demonstrate that this refrigerator, this furnace, this heat pump, whatever it is, cost X, and that was included in the purchase, you could still claim the credit. It's mostly as a matter of, as I say, convenience and the way the marketplace actually works, that sometimes doesn't happen. It certainly could, but for, like I say, for remodels and for customs, it's pretty direct.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Gentlemen, thank you. Thank you all very much. At this point, the only names that are not marked off are Jeff Bissonnette. Was Jeff here? And Gary Bauer and Bill Edmonds from Northwest Natural. And since Gary doesn't have Bill with him, I'll invite anyone else who might have gotten left off and wants to come forward at this point. Don't all rush up here. Okay. Lisa. Jeff, you want to go?
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. We were part of the work group that Senator Dingfelder and Representatives Cannon and Gilliam convened around these bills and around the RETC program. I wasn't going to sign up originally, but actually Representative Bailey brought up a question that sort of had me put my name to paper, and that was specifically, how does the cap or the allocation for this work in a RETC context as opposed to a Betsy context? And the answer is, rather than a cap, we were thinking about that number that would eventually be in the bill as an allocation or a budget to the Department of Energy for this program. And so most organizations this legislature, you know, has a budget, and I guess the model that we were looking at as part of our discussion was the Energy Trust for IOU territories and the individual consumer-owned utilities, and there were a couple of individual publicly-owned utilities as part of the work group who, you know, get a budget and have to manage to that budget and figure out how to get the biggest bang for the buck, in that case, on behalf of ratepayers. And I think what we were trying to get towards with this program is to ask the Department of Energy to get the biggest bang for the buck on behalf of ratepayers. And so while we understood there was going to be a limited amount of money dedicated toward this program to compensate for that, what they also needed was some of the flexibility rather than having set amounts by and large for particular measures, that they could be given the flexibility to move in and out of markets and change some of the credits on an ongoing basis. Again, this is I'm most familiar with the Energy Trust because that is where the dollars from the ratepayers I represent go to, and you have it's kind of an ongoing conversation with ratepayers in terms of what's being incented and how much, and so I think it would be definitely a new way to for the department to operate. I know that they understand there's a lot of people that are willing to help them think through this new approach, but that is kind of what the thinking came out of the from the work group, and I'm happy to answer more questions. Since I'll do just a couple of quick things. I was going to take a moment to talk about furnaces, but since Northwest Natural's up here, I'll let them do that. And then there was a comment made earlier about requiring certain measures before, for instance, solar, an incentive for solar is on. And we actually talked about that during the work group. And the Energy Trust did look at that approach a number of years ago as a way to target its own dollars and came up to the conclusion that folks that are looking at doing solar, by and large, had already done a lot of work, and so they decided that it wasn't a good way to target their resources, and they also found that even in households that hadn't done a lot of work, I will say that I think my memory serves correctly, they said that their research showed that people adding solar had houses that were 25% more efficient than the average. But even where that wasn't the case, once the solar went on, people were like, oh, you know, how can I make this even a better deal, and how can I do more energy efficiency? So it sort of worked both ways. But at the end of the day, that was determined by them, by the Energy Trust, not to be an effective way to target dollars. With that, I'll wrap up my comments and happy to answer questions at the appropriate time.
Why don't we let Gary go first, and then we'll have questions for the gentleman, and then we'll let the agency speak.
Thank you, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. I'm Gary Bauer, representing Northwest Natural. We would support maintaining the tax credits for the furnaces. The program has actually worked very well. We get calls on a regular basis, actually daily, from our customers asking what they should do in terms of replacing furnaces if they want to just replace one, or even in the new construction process. And we try to steer people towards high-efficiency furnaces. The code today, though, is for a 78% efficient furnace. The code at this point isn't scheduled to change until 2014, and they have not as yet identified what that new level might be. We find that as we talk to customers that the tax credit is definitely a factor in this process. The federal government did have a 30% up to $1,500 tax credit, which has expired. And we saw a large difference when that program went away in terms of people's attitudes towards whether or not to install a high-efficiency furnace. So it definitely drives consumer behavior. Another thing we also notice is that tax credits tend to send a signal as to almost this is where government thinks you ought to be spending your dollars. Whether you kind of agree with that or not, we have noticed that as we look at how we work with our customers. Another quick thing I might mention is that if you look at the chart that the Department of Energy gave you, it was one that multicolored one that gave you the different values next to ducts and heat energy recovery systems. Furnaces are your next best investment in terms of tax dollars to energy saved. I've got a lot of other information, which I'll just go ahead and submit later if you'd like. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Gary or Jeff?
Yes.
You said that the purchase of high-efficiency furnaces dropped off when the federal credit went away. Do you have data on that, the kind of before and after data?
Co-Chair and Senator Burdick, the tax credit just dropped off the end of this last year, so I can get some data. It'll probably be fairly limited, but we notice it in our conversations with customers. And if I might just kind of expand on that, the other gentleman that talked about his appliance dealer and whether or not he should be putting in and getting a tax credit, we have noticed in talking with heating and cooling contractors that they are trying to figure out where the tax credits and where the incentives are, because they are shifting and they're changing. And so I think there is definitely a number of them who are reluctant to talk about it because they don't want to give out the wrong information.
Yes, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Bissonnette, I'm hoping you can expound a little bit on the budget concept and help me understand if instead of a cap, we're allocating a budget to the Department of Energy for the RETC. Could the department then, under your idea, exceed that budget? What would happen if that budget was exceeded? And if they don't, if they cannot exceed the budget, then what's the distinction between the budget and the cap?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Bailey, I think we are a little bit in a potato-potato sort of situation. The answer is, you know, once you get the allocation, no, they couldn't exceed that. One of the things, though, that we specifically put in the reporting function that the Bureau has is they can come back and say, we are reaching the upper limits of that allocation that you did give us, and here's what we could do to if you wanted to allocate more money to us. And I guess I think, you know, the way I approach it is, you know, much the way my organization and as staff and management interacts with our board of directors is we're given a budget, we you know, we raise that budget and make adjustments, but as we're coming to the end of it, but there's an opportunity on a programmatic side or development side that's not in the budget, we go to the decision makers and say, this is an opportunity that we have or don't have, but we don't have the resources, we don't have the authority to do that. Would you like to give us that authority? And it's up to the decision makers to say yes or no. I think that we envision the same sort of situation between the legislature and the department.
Thank you. So if I understand what you're saying correctly, it's a little bit more than a potato-potato distinction between the cap and the budget, in that rather than having a statutory hard cap that would require legislation to change, the budget would set a dollar amount and give the department the opportunity at some point, if necessary, to make the case during the middle of a biennium, perhaps to an e-board or something, for an additional allocation. Is that the distinction that I'm hearing?
Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, I think that's correct. I think the argument could be made, however, that if you said no, that becomes a hard cap. I think that the argument could be made that even without section that we put in the legislation, the department could do that anyway. From our view, however, you know, without the express permission, we sort of doubted whether the department would feel comfortable making that. But if the legislature was at least authorizing that discussion, we thought that maybe that discussion might happen. But again, I think that I think the characterization that you just made is the characterization that and the way we were thinking about it as part of the work group.
Thank you.
Representative Telfer.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to the cap versus a budgetary allocation, given the
the need for certainty in the in these things. How would we sunset an allocation? I mean, you know, once it's in a budget, it's real hard to get it back out of a budget. So versus sunsetting a credit, how would you see that working?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, I think that we actually saw the amount in a biennial budget and the sunset as two different topics. So you set an amount as part of your budget. If the department wants to bring a discussion about that amount in the biennial budget and say, is there anything else the legislature can give for these purposes that we outlined, the legislature could say, nope, that's it. You know, there ain't no more, and that's fine. The sunset, however, is different, and the sunset in the bill, in both bills, Senate Bill 688 and House Bill 2522, is extended to 2018, and that's, again, aligned with a bunch of the other tax credits that that you're looking at. So we, the biennial budget, and if you prefer the biennial cap that you put on the program, we saw as different than sort of the program sunset, and that you then look at the program on down the line after a number of years and say, is this a credit we want to continue or not at that time?
Just to follow up, obviously that's very confusing, and I just think that sunsetting credits raises the awareness. People pay attention. If it's in a budget, it's difficult to retrieve this institutional history 10 years down the road that says, oh, that's right, we put something in a budget and we were going to come back and review it at some point. So it's my only concern with allocations versus credit caps or credit.
Further questions from these folks? Lisa, I'm going to have you go next, but I have noted that Brian Krieg was signed up. Is he in the room? If one of you gentlemen would vacate and let Brian come up. I am sorry I didn't catch your name there, Brian. And Lisa, you can go ahead. I'm just, and I'm last call. Anyone else on these two bills? Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, Lisa Pinero from the Oregon Department of Energy. I just really wanted to add that the department is looking at how we would implement a cap under this program, since the Residential Energy Tax Credit Program is an after-the-fact kind of tax credit. Applicants to our department are not required to be pre-certified by any means. They purchase the equipment or the furnace or do their duct sealing, and then they come to us after the fact to seek a tax credit for that. So we are looking at various different scenarios. The distinction between an appropriation and a cap isn't terribly clear to me today, but we'll be certainly working with the stakeholders to get an idea of what it is they're thinking of doing. Certainly we'll consult with this committee to determine how they want to proceed on that. We do have some concerns about the administration under a cap, but we are working on that. We also do want to bring to your attention the reporting requirements that's in Section 6 of the engrossed bill.
Which bill?
Senate Bill 688 is the one I was referring to. And I do not know the section in House Bill 2522. I apologize, but there are reporting requirements in there. And we would just bring to your attention that the bill today requires us to report every year in February. And we're just concerned that when this bill becomes effective, that we won't have a whole lot of data to report to you in the following February. So just wanted to kind of bring that to your attention, that that first report will probably be a little thin, but the annual reporting is of no concern to us. It's just that first reporting out of the gate.
Questions for Lisa? Thank you. Brian, sorry to have missed you the first round.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, that's fine. And actually, it's interesting. I think Mr. Chandler from the Home Builders summed up much of what I would say, and that this has been a very important...
Did you
For the record, the sheet metal and air conditioning contractors and the state association
their
of
name.
IBEW, Brian Krieg, sorry. the issue for us has been jobs, and this has been an area that has kept some of our contractors busy. It is something that we see is vital to the future for many of our more that are focused at the residential level and having a spread in their business of residential and small commercial. So this has been an important jobs issue for us. So thank you.
Thank you for coming forward. With no one else coming forward, thank you all, and thanks for your patience, those who had to wait. I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2522 and Senate Bill 688. I'm going to move committee down our agenda to opening House Bill, public hearing on House Bill 3597A, and ask Chris, since this is one we haven't talked about, to describe this credit.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3597 makes a change to the business energy tax credit. It modifies the definition of recycling facility to include equipment used solely for the processing waste plastic into synthetic crude oil, and applies to preliminary certifications issued on or after January 1, 2012, and it doesn't make any other changes to the Betsy program, including the sunsets.
Okay. Questions of staff? Thank you. We have the following people who signed up. I'm going to take Mike Dewey, Mark Simmons, and Marcia Kelly. You're not on all on the same side of this, but we'll take them in that order.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, Vice Chairs. For the record, Mike Dewey for Waste Management, Inc. Representative Gilliam spoke a bit about this bill to you earlier, I think maybe perhaps last week. And there was perhaps a perception that there would be just one company that would be taking advantage of the potential for a tax credit, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. But they're actually, and this is a little different because there are two policies in this bill. The first is the definition of recycling under the solid waste hierarchy, and then the consideration of a tax credit. Waste management is in the process of permitting a facility in Northeast Portland that would take what we consider low-grade plastic. And this would be your pens are not recyclable, coffee lids, the annoying plastic that you get at Costco, any retail store that you can't even open up with scissors. That is stuff that is not recyclable. And quite frankly, from a monetary standpoint, waste management benefits from that. That goes to the landfill. And it sits there. We mine landfills that we own to produce methane, therefore electricity, but this is stuff that just does not decompose. And so there is a new technology. Some of you went to the facility in Beaverton. I can't pronounce the name very well, Agulex, something like that. And we're investing in the same technology, and this is taking this low-grade plastic and converting it into synthetic crude oil. Now, that can go to a refinery. It can go somewhere else, and it could be made into plastic again. The highest and best use might be fuel. When we are up and running and have this facility permitted, I would say we have our land use permit. We're working through our air permit with DEQ and also our solid waste permit. So at the end of the day, when we're up and running full speed, we would be producing about 1.625 million gallons of crude oil. And obviously that has an impact on our environment by virtue of reusing this either for recycling or energy conversion. Part of the issue that is here before you today, in 1993, there was an Attorney General's opinion that said this technology is not recycling, it's energy conversion. And we worked with DEQ to work out this language, which we think is a compromise, to take the low-grade plastics that can't be recycled and they are reused rather than go to the landfill. So that's the first part of the issue. And we think that's good public policy. In other words, we're going to reuse this as opposed to putting it in the landfill. And we think there's a market for that. The second portion of this is the tax credit. And we're kind of in a conundrum here in that the Beaverton facility that does this has the research and development tax credit. I'm not an expert on tax credits, but I understand that there is only one of those, and that kind of makes sense to me. And in that this is energy conversion under the Attorney General's opinion and not recycling, we would not be eligible for a recycling tax credit. And as I understand, the Department of Energy has a rule that says if you have an air quality permit, you're not eligible for the energy conversion tax credit. So we're kind of in this conundrum of where to go. So this bill provides for that. And I did want to make sure and understand for the record that there are other companies that are also looking at this in that there would be more than one in the market. And we think there is enough plastic in the market in the Northwest to make these really work. And at the end of the day, we would have between 25 and 30 jobs at this facility in Northeast Portland, which we think will be built at some point. Thank you. Perhaps you want to have others speak.
Yeah, I'll have Mr. Simmons speak, and then we'll invite questions from both of you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Simmons, and I'm here to speak to you on behalf of Agilex and then on behalf of another company, Agriplas. With Agilex's blessing, you have this handout in front of you that includes some slides that were presented by Chris Ulam at the House hearing of 3597. And I want to draw your attention to the slide on the front page, lower left-hand corner, where it indicates where plastic comes from. It's pumped out of the ground and refined, made into plastic. We use it in our lives, that we discard it. And then it's collected and transported. And after it's collected and transported, 4% is exported, 13% is incinerated, 77% is landfilled, and only 6% is actually recaptured and recycled. The reason 77% is landfilled is two reasons. We have trained society that these pins are actually recyclable, and they don't all end up in the recycling. Sandwich wrappers, other items that just don't make it into the curbside single stream bucket where we put all the rest of our recyclables. So with this single stream curbside box, we put everything in there. It goes to a facility where it is sorted. The obvious things like milk jugs and soda bottles can be pulled out. The rest goes into a heap of mixed plastic. In order to recycle plastic effectively, you've got to sort it by resin type. And it's just not practical. It's not economically efficient. We just can't do that. So it all goes either off to the landfill or to China, where Lord knows what happens to it. A lot of it, I believe, is burned in China. And so we don't have a use for it. This technology, the Agilex technology, provides a path to use this waste. 8% of the oil that we pump out of the ground gets converted into plastic. And of that, 77% is landfilled, because we just don't have a better alternative. We can't. It's not efficient. It's not profitable to encourage people to put more plastic into that curbside container when there's really nothing to do with it once it gets to the sorting facility. This technology provides an answer to that. The impact to Oregon. We could divert over 300 million pounds of plastic from landfills or incinerators. We could produce 1,000 permanent, sustainable, green jobs, just as some of the highlights. It is a new, we believe, recycling technology and should be recognized as such. But as Mr. Dewey pointed out, the technology here has outpaced the regulatory framework that applies to it. The Agriplas facility is permitted to operate this equipment. They're an early adopter. However, they're permitted as if they were a landfill. The most egregious, burdensome permitting category available to the Department of Energy, of Environmental Quality, because there's not a clear place to put it. There's not a clear bucket. It doesn't fit anywhere. And that was is part of the issue this legislation answers, giving the department clear guidance as how to permit this type of activity in the state of Oregon. It is a compromise. We don't believe it is energy recovery, but we'll agree to it for purposes of moving the bill. The oil produced is an industrial feedstock that can be made back into plastic or many, many other products, and in fact has the potential to put all of society's consumption of waste of plastic into a closed loop. And that's pretty phenomenal stuff. Coming right out of Oregon. Oregon has a reputation as a leader in the environmental community, in practical solutions to environmental problems, and this is one that we should be opening the door and making a path for rather than inhibiting and not supporting. 2 years ago, the Department of Energy was presented with a BETSI application, and it was granted to Agilex. To install their system in Tigard. The department has since then, it was certified as a pre-certified as a research and development tax credit. The department has since discouraged any future applications because they don't have a clear path for this. We believe it should qualify for the recycling market development tax credit, which is 35% of qualifying capital costs. It's not like renewables at 50%. It's a much different tier. Agroplast is an early adopter. They want to take this Agilex technology and apply it on the ground and process waste plastic that they don't have a good market for into crude oil. Rather than ship it to China at 3 or 4 cents a pound. We believe that all waste should be recycled to whatever its highest and best use is. And I believe that's something we can all agree on. Highest and best use of all products and resources that we have is really the way to go. There's been some concern that milk jugs, for example, would get put into this process rather than recycled through processes that are available, channels that are available to recycle milk jugs. The fact is, milk jugs are worth more to recycle them back into other plastic containers than they would be if you put them into the oil system. The market will dictate highest and best use if we allow it to. So with that, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, thank you. We do need clear regulatory guidance, and we would benefit very much from having the tax credit available.
Thank you. Committee members, questions of these two gentlemen?
Yes. Madam Chair, I'm not hearing worries that the industry will stop in its tracks if this tax credit is not made available. Am I correct in that? I mean, if this tax credit is not made available, do you see the industry coming to a halt?
A question for me, I take it.
Both of you, actually.
Okay. Senator Burdick, Madam Chair, Senator Burdick, the quicker we can roll out new technologies, the more benefit they will provide to society. If without the tax credit, it will take much, much longer. And this is a very labor-intensive process. The system that the folks at Agroplast want to put in would employ 55 people, benefited, sustainable, year-round jobs. And it will happen, but it will happen much slower without the tax credit.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm going to answer this a little bit differently. And hopefully my client isn't listening. The reason I say this is that the company that Mr. Simmons represents is more of a startup, I think. We're integrated in the system. We thought there would be a tax credit available. We were somewhat discouraged that we really haven't had a good answer from the Department of Energy as to whether or not this applies, albeit as we would do in due diligence. We applied for a tax credit. and then starting to understand how the rules work. Because we're more integrated, there is perhaps more opportunity, and I think we would go ahead one way or the other because we have the way we have the system in place. We have the transfer station. We collect the material. So it's a different mechanism, a different animal, if you will, for us as opposed to a startup. So I could see where a startup would need this infusion because we think this will be something we'll do in other states because this – but it's this is very expensive. These vessels, I was surprised how much money they are. And this is not an inexpensive technology. And you need air permits and solid waste permits. So it's not like you're running on the cheap here by any means. So I can understand where Mr. Simmons comes from.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, quickly.
Thank you. Waste management gets the waste from the metropolitan urban areas. Agroplast has been in the business for 15 years of recycling primarily ag waste. The industrial, the large aggregators such as waste management don't get out in the rural areas and gather, such as in Oregon, the huge amount of nursery plastic, drip irrigation tubing, the fittings, the type of hose, it's all, they're all different types of plastic commingled in there that there's not a good solution for. And as an early adopter, this would make all the difference in the world.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart, you had your hand up, and then
thank you, Madam Chair. Through reading the materials from last time and listening to those answers, I think my questions have been answered. Thank you.
Representative Wan.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'd be interested to see from you gentlemen what the cost is to your companies to get through the permitting process, both, and if you could separate it out by environmental and land use, so that I can compare that to the expected tax credit benefit that you might receive from these from this bill, that would be a big help to me. And if you wouldn't mind just emailing it to my office, I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Perhaps all of us would be interested.
We're happy to do it. It's we have found that it's a little more complicated than we thought it was going to be. As you get into this morass, and then
I'm shocked.
Pulled in.
Thank you.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. I have a question that I perhaps should have asked to the policy committee members, but I hadn't formed it at that point. I've gotten some correspondence from some folks who are concerned about the different impacts and values and effects of different kinds of plastics and products that you might produce through this process. Has there been any thought, or did you have discussion in the previous committee about any hierarchy or additional benefits to different types based on where it's going?
Madam Chair, Representative Reed, we really believe that the inherent value, residual value, if you will, of various types of plastic, that the market will control where it goes in the end, such as the milk jugs. It's just much more profitable to grind that milk jug material up and send it off to be made into new containers than it is to make it into oil. As the price of crude oil goes up, the price of these plastic resins goes up as well, because that is the source of new material, the crude oil. And so we really don't see this as a conflict with any kind of recycling hierarchy.
May I clarify?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I think I may have been less than clear. I don't think it's so much about the value in dollars and cents of what comes out, but the potential effect. And to be specific, for one example, there's concern about PVC, and I know that's been a specific matter of discussion, but less about the dollars, because I agree with you, the market will have something to say about that, but about the other effects.
If I may, co-chairs Representative Reed. So this is part of the issue is for this kind, these types of facilities, and they vary, would be, first of all, is this a solid waste facility? And rules come with that. And we are presented from DEQ with three ways of sorting that out as we move forward with a facility in Northeast Portland. So that's the first part. And so that's regulated, and you pay a fee, and there's inspections. So there was an incident with a tire recycler that left town, and they didn't have enough resources to clean it up. So I think DEQ is going to be able to deal with those issues in terms of that part of the environment on the solid waste side. The other part of this is the air permit, and what do you do to mitigate in terms of the air side of the equation. So those are the two issues that I see that are, you know, at issue for the environment. I'm looking forward to my friend's testimony to my right to hear what these arguments are, because I haven't heard them. And in that, this you've got a clear distinction as to, does it go to a landfill by and large, or do you make it into a material that we think has a higher and better use? That's, we think, is the distinction, so long as you have the regulatory framework in place, and DEQ is pretty good at that. Hopefully that answered your question.
Somewhat. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions for these gentlemen? All right, Marcia, you're on.
thank you, Chair Berger. Co-Chair Berger, Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. My name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. And I come here not to talk about the policy, whether capturing the plastics into oil is appropriate or not. I come here on the tax credit issue. It's amazing what you learn when you have a chance to work on different tax credits in different industries. The plastic to fuel, or agulix, is a testimony to the benefits that people have from getting higher education, and especially higher education in Oregon. I'll send you some profiles of the people who are the leaders in the company of Agulix. It's heavily OSU, U of O, and a little bit of mix of the West Coast, Utah, and the University of California and the University of Washington, but heavily OSU. The founder of the company had a BS in chemistry and physics, and did graduate work at OSU.
My majors, by the way. Yeah.
Sure, Mike. Sure, I've known you too long. So we should be proud of our university system and what it produces. Our concern is the tax credit. Agulix, yes, is a startup company. They've had venture capital to begin with. I believe at the end of March they got a $22 million additional venture capital investment. The process is patented. I heard Senator Morris ask that question, I believe, last week. The process is patented. And they're selling their patent, the use of their patent, they're in negotiations with other companies around the United States. So our concern is the tax credit. They have venture capital money. They're established. They have Agriplas, which has gotten business tax credits or business help, both through the county and the state, to do their projects. Agriplas is very good. They think that there's 170 million pounds of plastic lying around in the fields in Oregon, and they've worked very well with the nurseries to set up a system. So this is not a total startup. And so the tax credit is where we split with my friend to the right. I think that if you want to change, whether it's recycling or recapture, whatever you want to do with that is fine, because that's your prerogative. I want to make sure that we're not, through tax credits, incentive things that already are happening and are already viable. Because what you give away in tax credits does not get spent on other projects that are important to Oregonians. And because it's Women's Health and Wellness, National Women's Health Week, I'd like to just call out one program that we do not fund, and that's breast cancer treatment for women who do not have insurance.
Right. However, that's not written into this bill. Thank you.
But the use of the money.
We get your point. Questions for Marcia? Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Randy Tucker, Palmer Mason. And anyone else? This is the end of my list on this bill, so I'm calling out. There's another place up here for anyone else on this bill.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, I was sitting in the back of the room having not signed up today, but having sent a note up on last Thursday. So I'm a little bit on the edge about testifying on this bill for a couple of reasons. One is that I'm not testifying to the tax credit element to it, and we have no comment about the tax credit. We actually, I didn't identify myself, did I?
I don't believe you did.
Randy Tucker.
And your client.
Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. Excuse
Thank
me.
You.
We're not commenting really on the technology that's being discussed. The concern that we have and that has left us, frankly, a little confused as to the impact of this bill has to do with the effect that it may have on the solid waste hierarchy, which is a statement of policy that the state makes as to how to manage solid waste and what the priorities are for the management of solid waste. And it's not clear, 100% clear to us, that the changes in the policy that are laid out in sections 2 and 3 of the bill are actually necessary for the purpose that I believe the proponents are bringing this bill forward, having to do with the tax credit. So I may be reading their intent and the impact of the policy wrong, but I'm raising the question. The concern that we have is that the policy that's in ORS, I'll have to look at the bill, for 59015, that's the solid waste hierarchy, has been sort of worked out over time by many stakeholders in the solid waste system, and this bill would essentially declare legislatively that a certain process is recycling, it's not, I don't know that the analysis has been done to actually demonstrate that the benefits of this process are equivalent to the benefits of recycling. And so we're expressing this concern on the record without taking a position on the tax credit or the actual technology itself. So I just wanted to raise that issue and happy to bring certified smart people down to answer any further questions you may have on that topic.
Thank you, Randy. Palmer.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I want to say a couple different things about House Bill 3597. First, the department agrees to go forward with the language in sections 2 and 3 of the bill. We were fortunate to work out with the bill sponsor, Representative Gilliam, and Mr. Simmons, and Mike Dewey, and others, the issues. I think the reason we support going forward with this is it does make an exception to the solid waste hierarchy, and that, as Randy pointed out, is not to be taken lightly. There's a lot of environmental analysis and data that supports the hierarchy and the preferences that are under that we prefer reduce, reuse, recycling, so forth, over energy recovery. Mr. Dewey mentioned the Attorney General opinion, which was actually issued in 1994, that defined this type of process, this process of using pyrolysis, as energy recovery. And the reason the Attorney General opined in that way is that the difference is recycling is a process where the material gets converted again and again repeatedly into new material. And what is happening with Agilex and the pyrolysis facility is that the material is being converted into a fuel. Now, I will acknowledge, and they have said this repeatedly, and I think it is in their business plan, that they may eventually use the material not at the end point of a fuel, but also for other products. And certainly waste management has talked about the same thing. And so I want to acknowledge that. But the reason we made the exception to the guidance in the solid waste hierarchy was that, as Mr. Simmons and Mr. Dewey both pointed out, the material that we're talking about here is a waste plastic that is typically low-grade and dirty when otherwise go to the landfill. And from our point of view, it made sense to take that type of material and convert it into another material, in this case crude oil, rather than have it go to the landfill, and because they were doing so, they were making an economically viable product for Oregon. So that made sense to us to make an exception to this guidance that we have in the statute about preferring true recycling, where the product is made again and again and again over energy recovery. So in that case, we worked with them on language that is narrowly tailored to provide that the plastic in question cannot otherwise be economically recycled and is limited to being converted under pyrolysis to another useful material. I did want to say, though, a couple of things about some impressions that you may have been left with in the prior testimony, and that is when it comes to recycling here in Oregon, most of the recycling material that we collect is processed domestically, and also you may have been left with the impression that most of the recycling that we see is through your curbside, and while a lot of that does happen, recycling takes place in many different venues and in many different businesses. It happens in industrial settings, commercial settings, household settings. So I didn't want you to be left with the impression that recycling is really only a function of the curbside pickup. It is not. It is much broader than that. And also, you may have heard that a lot of the materials that are collected and moved offshore to places like China are burned. The department does not believe that is the case. We have direct evidence, testimony from people who've gone over there to China, where the materials are collected and converted into new products. There is not burned. And also the Chinese and other foreign markets are paying many hundreds of dollars a ton for this material, and it doesn't make sense that they would actually burn this. So I didn't want the committee to be left with that impression. But in the end, I want to say to the committee, we agree to go forward with this language. We think it makes sense given the type of waste plastic that we're talking about, a very low-grade stuff that would not otherwise be recycled, and that we're limiting to the use to pyrolysis. One more comment, and then I can certainly take any questions the committee may have. I wanted to point out there's a potential inconsistency between Section 1 of the bill and Section 3 of the bill. Section 1 is the portion of the bill that talks about when the tax credit would apply. Section 3 is the portion of the bill that defines when the use of this type of waste plastic is actually counted as recycling. If you look at the language in Section 1 of the bill, it is much broader than the language in Section 3 of the bill. It could potentially apply to other conversion technologies. It would not be limited to just pyrolysis. It could also apply to facilities that are using conversion technologies and taking high-grade plastic, the milk jugs and the other things that were referenced in the prior testimony. And I think the department would suggest to you that that would not be a beneficial use of the tax credit. Those are the type of high-grade materials that we'd like to see stay in the current recycling stream and get converted to other products, not fuel, but other products, and get made that way. The environmental uses would be much better. The environmental benefits greater. And I should point out there are a lot of businesses and firms that work in that material here in Oregon, so it doesn't serve them well to have a tax credit divert that material away from their businesses and their business plans. So I would just offer this up to the committee or point out that it might be necessary to reconcile the language in Section 1 with the language in Section 3 and make that a bit tighter. And I can certainly take any questions the committee may have.
Questions for these gentlemen? I have a couple of comments. This has been a very interesting discussion for me of recycling. I am very happy to be sitting in this room today arguing over the uses of our garbage. It is a fine argument to have because too long we have just thrown it away and said it doesn't exist anymore and who cares. We do care. And so this discussion is a very positive step in terms of the value of the things that we have been throwing away for generations. So while we might be arguing over that, it is a good argument to be having. Thank you. With that, and I see no one else came up to fill that third chair, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3597A, and I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2196A. We're going to change staff, and while Mazin talks about this, I'm going to invite
co-chair Representative Bailey to come forward to talk about this bill.
Who first?
Him.
Did you just say
2196?
2196. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I believe this is my first bill with the JTAX committee, so that's an occasion, and I feel kind of like I'm intruding on the Betsy Ratsy dating game, so I apologize for that. The House Bill 2196 it is a primary within the same type of definitions that you're talking about. It is a tax credit that is being discussed and offered, to be offered, if this bill passes, for the fuels, diesel fuel, or diesel tax, diesel fuel that would be produced from cooking oil. So the cooking oil will be transferred into diesel, blended with diesel, and the resulting gallon would get a tax exemption from the fuel tax that exists today, which is 30 cents per gallon.
Madam Chair,
yes,
we are cracking up down at this end of the podium because our evaluation format says creates exemption from fuel tax for cooking oil made from biodiesel, and we don't think that
gross.
Sounds very tasty. At this end of the podium.
You're not anxious for that cooking oil.
Get on popcorn.
No, Representative Bailey, please. I'm sorry.
Thank
I'm
you,
sorry for this side of the table. Apologize for this end.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jules Bailey, House District 42. If I keep looking over my shoulder, I believe Representative Wingard's staff is attempting to get him out of committee if possible.
I did try and stall a few minutes to get him here, but he's not.
I appreciate that. We have several more items before us today, so I'll do my best to keep it brief, but I want to take a few minutes and talk to you a little bit about House Bill 2196, which is actually a more complex bill than it is on its face. And I want to talk to you a little bit more about the rationale behind it, why we've worked on it, and what it's intended to achieve. House Bill 2196 is a bit of a horse of a different color for this committee. I first want to explain that this is not an income tax credit. We have spent most of the time in this committee working on income tax credits. What this is an exemption around diesel taxation. And where this bill came from was a discussions between myself and Representative Wingard, who's been working with me on this bill, and a shared concern that we had over biofuels that have the potential to impact the price of food and food supply, and also a concern about the difference between kinds of biofuels when it comes to their overall environmental impact. And Representative Winger can talk a little bit more about some of those impacts. So in looking at the different kinds of biofuels that are available, we focused in on biodiesel that is made from used cooking oil. And the reason that, and we can hear more about this from some of the certified smart people, but the reason that biodiesel made from used cooking oil is different than biodiesel made from virgin oil products direct from the farm to you. Is that this is essentially a form of recycling. When restaurants are finished with the leftover grease, with the leftover cooking oil, they pay to dispose of that waste product. Instead, you have companies that specialize in collecting this product and processing it into biodiesel. And for the record and for full disclosure, I drive a 2005 Jeep Liberty CRD that I run on used cooking oil biodiesel. I run it on 100% blend, and you can mix it in any proportion with regular diesel. It runs great, and I get great gas mileage, and the only downside is that I have cars that tailgate me trying to smell my exhaust because it smells like French fries. And this has been lovingly referred to as the French fry bill.
But when you go through that whole process with used cooking oil, you are, one, mitigating the food price impacts of the biodiesel, and two, it has a much, much lower carbon footprint compared to other forms of biodiesel because it is turning waste into fuel. And three, it by definition is a local product because it's coming from local restaurants being collected, and restaurants are now getting paid for waste that they otherwise had to pay to dispose of. This is then made into fuel and sold. So, as we examine how we might shift the share and promote the use of used cooking oil, our first path was to examine if there was a way to include this in our renewable fuel standard in the 2% or 5% that's sold around the state in biodiesel. Well, it turns out that that's actually extremely complex, and for a number of reasons, there isn't the capacity to include the blend in the proportion that we'd like, and because of the way that some of the contracts are done with retail providers of biodiesel that meet that RFS mandate. So we decided to take a bit of a different approach, and that approach was to give the market a nudge in the direction of shifting that share and saying that there is a public policy reason to have a distinction between these blends of biodiesel. And one of the things that I think this committee has focused on very heavily is the stickiness of the investments that we give. Are we able to make an investment that then can sunset and give the market a nudge for a public policy reason? And I think that this really fits that criteria. There's a six-year sunset on this exemption. And what the bill does is it exempts blends of B20, so that's 20% biodiesel and above, that's made exclusively from used cooking oil. This is a very small share of the market of what's being sold, especially because the bill further limits it to vehicles under 10,000 pounds. So that's small vehicles, light vehicles. So this isn't the big trucks that are filling up. So the impact is actually pretty small. You're not going to see Chevron going out and digging a new hole in the ground and putting a new tank in to start offering B20 or B100. But for those retailers that are looking at selling that specialty blend of B20 and above for that market, it gives them a reason to start choosing used cooking oil over some of these other forms of biodiesel that have those negative impacts. And so the hope is to be able to nudge the market in that direction and then sunset that exemption to provide for that increased capacity and be able to establish sort of a little bit more of a baseline and a presence for that used cooking oil-based biodiesel within the market, and to have a policy statement that not all blends are created equal. So that's the intent of the bill. I'll pause there and turn it over to my colleague.
Welcome, Representative Wingert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Representative Matt Wingert from House District 26. I don't want to talk about the specifics of the bill because I think Representative Bailey has done that. I just want to implore you all to seize any opportunity, even an opportunity that is a bill of modest goals, as this one is, to correct a very serious public policy mistake that we have made in this country by diverting our agricultural production, which essentially is food for the world and the citizens of this country, at an ever-increasing rate into our transportation sector. It is hard for us, living as we do and having the lifestyle we do, to understand fully or to comprehend the impact that that is having out in the world where people live on the margin. And even modest increases in food prices can actually result in people starving to death. We enjoy in this country a great deal of progress over many, many decades that has produced a situation where the share of our incomes that goes to pay for food is actually quite small compared to the situation that other people on the planet find themselves in, where the share of their income that goes to pay for their food is significant. These movements in price are noticed by them much more keenly than perhaps we do in this country. And we have gone down the path with ethanol and diverted a large segment of our corn production into the transportation sector. And I'm not sure that we will ever fully comprehend the impact that that had in the world on other folks. So I'm imploring you to seriously consider this very modest proposal to begin to embrace the idea of alternative fuels, but are alternative fuels that do not come directly from our agricultural sector. And it's not just land that is used to grow food, and that food, like corn, is directed into ethanol production. It's also land that is being used to grow things that are not edible but end up in our fuel production, but that land would otherwise have grown something that most likely would have been edible food, either consumed here in this country or shipped somewhere else in the world. I handed out a packet of some of the more recent articles on this issue with some very compelling quotes. I don't want to take too much time or overstate it, but and again, this bill is modest, but when Representative Bailey told me he had an idea for moving forward on the idea of alternative fuels, but doing it in a way that would bypass our agricultural and food production sector, I was, as he knows, very enthusiastic about supporting him on that. I have been talking about this since I entered the legislature 2 years ago, and I'm happy to answer your questions.
Representative Gilster has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a bill this session with a related clause related to yellow grease. I have a constituent, Beaver Biodiesel, who has been using cooking oil in order to turn into biodiesel, but the problem that he has run into is there is a lack of regulation of the quality of the cooking oil that is coming out of the restaurants. So in this particular case, he was one of our first Boost recipients, used that to leverage the ability to bring more in, and it completely destroyed a batch of biodiesel because the cooking oil that they sold had been adulterated. There was sewage that had leaked into the yellow grease and really destroyed the entire investment. If we are moving towards encouraging more restaurants to sell their cooking oil, what enhancements might you propose or see to better regulate the quality of that yellow grease that's being sold, and how will we hold restaurants accountable for ensuring the quality of that product that they're sending on into our fuel supply source?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Gelser, thanks for the question. I think your question also gets at really the heart of this bill, which is something I think I failed to say very clearly, which is the intention of this bill is not to shift demand, but to shift supply, which is something different than what we often see. And in my mind, the answer to your question is really that I think the market will take care of a lot of that. As you have an increased market for this used cooking oil from restaurants, and restaurants know that they're going to be able to sell that into the market, the people that are choosing to purchase from these restaurants, there will be good actors and bad actors, and they'll purchase from the ones that are providing good quality biodiesel first and not from those that are providing them a poor product. We have folks who are in that business who could probably address that a little bit more, but that would be my initial instinct.
And just a follow-up, I think there's great promise moving forward in this area. Just working with him to try to find some accountability, it was clear that there's kind of a hole in the accountability system. Is it ag? Is it ODO? Is it the health department? There were a whole bunch of different organizations that you might see plugging into this situation, but it's something I think we'll need to look at more on the policy side. Great bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative
Wan. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Bailey, I'm interested in the market nudge concept, and my concern is that when we create a new tax credit for the purpose of nudging the market, that we would need to make sure that the tax credit would go to some unique fixed startup cost that is not otherwise able to be amortized over the lifetime or a short time of the business, so that when the tax credit goes away in 6 years, that business is able to be profitable over the long term. Is there any analysis in this type of industry of what kind of that startup fixed cost is that this tax credit would go to help them get on a plane and then right into profitability, so that we don't have to extend this perpetuity?
Co-Chair Berger, Representative Wan. That's a great question, and this, I think, is a little bit of a different model of a market nudge than some of the other ones that we've addressed. We already have several companies that are up and running on producing some of this kind of fuel, and it's really more of an issue of that sort of distributor level contractual arrangements where sort of the default is on where you purchase your biodiesel from. And so it's really about shifting the market around the supplier end and then how that then rebounds to increase certainty and capacity around those existing companies. And the hope is that with this 6-year sunset on the bill, that we can get people used to that are providing these B20 blends or these B100 blends used to signing the contracts that will then purchase that from those existing suppliers to give them sort of the certainty to be able to go out and get financing on the open market and through the private sector. So that's the intention rather than providing a direct subsidy to any particular business or any kind of income tax credit.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it. We have two more folks signed up here, Jody Weiser and Tyson Kiever. That is all I have signed up. If there's anyone else who wants to speak to this, please come forward now. We will stay to hear this testimony, and then committee members. ODOT is in the room to answer further questions on this if there are questions. They have given us a handout. So I'm afraid we've got just a couple more minutes.
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. I'll try to speak quickly. So the taxpayers of Oregon have already subsidized this industry quite a lot. Pat mentioned it early, 4.6% to Sequential. We found yesterday the names of two other smaller, much smaller companies that are also receiving benefits. And so our concern is, well, we keep adding and adding and adding. When do we stop adding? And we have two places we're subsidizing this fuel source right now. Before you have today the RETC, which has $200 per year cap for someone who is using the fuel. And then this would add another place where you would get another $200. And it seems you could choose between the two of those rather than do both. Of the two choices, this is more targeted. The RETC does any biodiesel that's used in home heating or vehicles, and this will just use the cooking oil biodiesel, which is truly a remarkable product in its ability to recycle something that has already had its carbon costs accounted for in the making of the cooking oil. And it's going to be collected and sent someplace, so it might as well be sent to making fuel that we can use instead of just discard it someplace. But the most of our subsidy has been through the Betsy, which has helped with plant building, plant expansions, the vehicles that transport the oil for collection and for distribution, the stations where they can pump the fuel either at fleet locations or at public locations, and then also the subsidy for the users that would be in this bill through the fuel tax or in the RETC through the tax credit. So you can see on the spreadsheet how much we are spending on Sequential or have spent on Sequential already. And if the Betsy is continued, we would continue to support them through the Betsy because they would continue to expand and hopefully the other companies would grow. The fact that this is a remarkable source of biodiesel, it's also true that it is limited. You know, it is as clean as a dam on a river that's creating hydropower if the river has no fish in it. It's got, you know, it's remarkable. Well, we have very few rivers without fish where we can build another dam, and there's only so much cooking oil to be used. There's only so much waste grease to be used, and actually we're hoping to get people to use less of it to increase our health.
And so it's not the big solution, but it is a small portion of the solution.
Would you stay with this bill? Because we are losing committee members and we still have testimony.
Right. And we would recommend that you move this bill rather than the RETC piece. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody. Mr. Kieber, we appreciate your patience in sitting through and being the final testifier today. I note that you do have a letter. I would prefer that you not read it, but summarize your remarks, and we are interested in your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and Vice Chairs, remaining members of the committee. My name is Tyson Kieber. I am managing partner of Sequential Biofuels and Sequential Pacific Biodiesel and Encore Oils. We're a vertically integrated biodiesel company that specializes in collecting cooking oil from the restaurant, taking it to our production facility in South Salem, converting it into a usable transportation fuel that is very low carbon, and then delivering it to a network of pumps throughout the region. This bill, specifically House Bill 2196, has two primary objectives for our business that I would like to speak to. The first is a hurdle that we have today. This bill will help incentivize the commercial delivery infrastructure to accept the use of this lower carbon recycled cooking oil-based biodiesel into the delivery mechanism. In the pipelines today, in the most of the commercial terminals, they do not, and in the barges that take product to Eastern Oregon, they do not allow cooking oil biodiesel in that infrastructure. Primarily, Big Oil controls these vessels and these delivery assets. And the rationale, even though we have the same quality specification for virgin oil biodiesel, it's just a prejudice against recycled cooking oil. So this helps incentivize them to pay attention to it and help us make this product more available to the consumer. The second big point of the bill for us is encouraging higher demand, encouraging demand on higher blends of biodiesel. Every gallon of biodiesel we use in the state has significant trickle-down effects from creating jobs, getting dollars revolving in the local economy. We have a B5 RFS in the state. 20% means that much more product going to dollars revolving local economy, that much cleaner tailpipes, that many more jobs. Restaurants benefit from it, collectors benefit from it, producers benefit from it, retailers benefit from it, and consumers benefit from it. Our business is healthy today. We really appreciate the support of the state and where we've come so far. This bill is targeted at supporting recycled cooking oil to biodiesel. And I really appreciate your time. I'm available for any questions. I've submitted written testimony, and my contact information is on there if you'd like to follow up later.
Thank you very much. Questions? Jody, it was your testimony that you do support this bill?
Yes, but by leaving the piece out of the RETC so that we don't double up.
Okay, and you also support this bill?
Yes, I do.
So Jody Weiser and Sequential are agreed on this bill.
This is true.
Thank you very much for both of you for coming in. I appreciate your testimony. And with that, committee members, we are going to, yes. I don't have any more testimony on this one. Yeah, those all carry over, but I'm going to close this one first. I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2196. I'm going to carry over to our next meeting, which is Tuesday of next week, and I apologize for those who have come and signed up, but we ran out of time. House Bill 2524, Senate Bill 822, and Senate Bill 903 will be carried over to our next meeting date, which is Tuesday. And with that, all business done. We are adjourned. All business done. We are adjourned.